I'm Mindy Todd. Welcome to The Point. This morning we talk birds. A little later in the hour, ornithologist Vernon Locks joins us to talk about the Nantucket Birding Festival. But first, anyone familiar with Mike O'Connor's weekly Ask the Bird Folks column in the Cape Codder knows you get an answer to the bird question, but not without some good-natured ribbing at the expense of the questioner and a few humorous tangents. Mike compiled many of the obscure questions he's been asked in his column as owner of the Birdwatchers General Store, and his latest book is Why Do Bluebirds Hate Me? Mike, welcome to the studio this morning.
Welcome, Mindy.
Okay, so your book, Why Do Bluebirds Hate Me? Where did the title come from? Somebody actually thinks bluebirds hate them?
Well, a lot of people do. 30 years ago, nobody cared about bluebirds. It wasn't a big deal. And then as things changed, as people started putting up more and more boxes, the area had lost a lot of its bluebird population that it had about 100 years ago. And a lot of the natural cavities were taken over by starlings and sparrows, house sparrows particularly. And so people started putting out nest boxes, and they put out these bluebird trails. I think they did over by Marston's Mills Airport and certain places along golf courses, particularly power line right-of-ways. And as the population grew, we started seeing the birds coming back again. So 30 years ago, there wasn't any to speak of. Very few people saw them. And now recently, the last 20, 15, 10 years, the population has really returned, and people are getting them not only in their nest boxes, but in their yards, especially in the wintertime. So now it's become a status symbol. Before it was, you know, like, I saw one. Now I have some.
And bluebirds.
My bluebirds. And so not everybody gets them. Yeah. And some people are concerned, why don't I get them? What have I done wrong?
Why don't they like me? Yeah, which is exactly what the guy was questioning. But he probably has a yard like mine, which isn't that attractive to bluebirds. They like some open space.
They actually like open space. Well, there's two ways you can get bluebirds. One is nesting season, during the nesting season. So if you have either a wide open yard or a yard that's near wide open area, near a cranberry bog, say, or a golf course, or maybe over by the Barnstable County, where they have the
fairgrounds. Yeah,
fairgrounds, exactly. You've got a good chance of getting them if you live near there. But if you live in a heavy wooded area, you're not likely to get them, except maybe in the wintertime, because we get a huge bluebird population in the winter. We're not really clear if the summer bluebirds don't leave or if we get a lot of wintering bluebirds that come from, say, inland and further north. But the Cape has a good population of bluebirds here in the wintertime, and they're attracted to any yards that have berries, like holly berries or winter berries. So if you've got a berry population in your yard, you might get some bluebirds. But the other thing they come for is water and suet and sunflower seeds without the shell. So if you've got that kind of working for you, you might get a visit.
I got to keep my eyes open for a visitor then. So the book is a series of bird questions from your column, and it sort of takes off from your first book, which was Why Don't Woodpeckers Get Headaches? And other bird questions you know you want to ask. So you obviously couldn't fit everything into that first book. So the second book is some more of those questions.
Yeah,
right?
It is. You know, we've been doing this column for almost 14 years. So, the first book came out in 2007. So this has just kind of picked up with that. It's a compilation of the questions that we get over the years.
And this, you have a question here that refers back to that first book. It says, Dear Bird Folks, I found your book on bird advice in our local library. I enjoyed reading it, but I have a question. On page 88, you advise us to remove all the old seed from our bird feeders each time we fill them. Then after we add new seed, you said to put the old seed back on the top. But since most tube-style bird feeders feed from the bottom, won't the fresh seed be eaten first while the old seed now on the top won't get eaten?
I got a lot of people call me on that one.
Yeah, you're like, uh-oh.
Well, the idea is to clean your feeder each time you fill it. Make sure it's empty.
So not the season, every single time.
Every single time. Okay. Never top off and feeder. This is what we get. People are going, Bill, the feeder's almost empty. Can you fill them? So Bill goes out with his can of bird food, and he just pours it right in the top. And the bottom seed has gathered moisture either from rain or from just dew. And the bottom seed also has debris because the birds don't eat the debris, so they leave it there. Mm. So it kind of piles up and then gets moist, and then it turns into mold,
clumpy.
And it gets really bad. Yeah, it gets clumpy. And you would not believe the stinky feeders people bring in because, the bird's uncoming, and they bring the feeder.
And you're going, there's why.
Oh, yeah.
Would you eat that? Yeah.
Exactly. So what I tell people to do is to dump that feeder out each time. I prefer just dump it on the ground, let the sparrows and the doves clean it up. Right. But if you're conservative and you want to save some, then at least dump out the debris and save the seed, and then you can rotate it on the
mix
top.
It
of
in.
What I do, yeah, I put it in a container and shake it up so it kind of rotates it. But just that'll give you a chance to visually check the food before you put it. If it looks crummy, throw it out. But never top off a feeder. That's the point I'm trying to get.
Okay. All right. That's a good advice. And if you want some advice from Mike, give us a call, 866-999-4626. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. So while we're talking about the feeders here, you know, this is a big question. You know, you want to attract as many different types of birds as you can. So what you're putting in your feeders is important because certain birds like certain type of seed, right? So do you advise putting the sunflower seeds in one feeder, something else in the other, or is it good to mix them? Does it matter? What's your advice on?
Yeah, my advice has always been single ingredients in a feeder.
Really? Okay.
So like you said, sunflower seed would be great in a feeder. That's actually the more popular. Mm-hmm. Another feeder could have thistle seed or niger seed, as some people call it. That's an alternative, and that's a good thing. You get mostly goldfinches with that, and sometimes chickadees come to that. And then a suet feeder, a separate suet feeder. Those are the three things you really – the idea of a mixed seed is really Madison Avenue's way of marketing bird food. The thought of having a variety of food will get you a variety of bird doesn't really hold up.
Oh,
no,
interesting.
I mean, when you do a mixture, when a bird lands on a plant, the bird picks out only one kind of seed comes from that plant. There's not a variety of food.
Gotcha.
So they're locked into one food, and their favorite food being sunflower seed. If you mix in any other kind of seed, no matter what the other seed is, it's going to end up on the ground.
So they're just throwing that away.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then you end up with a mess on the ground, and the people call up and say, I got a lot of pigeons. Well, you know, guess what?
Or rats.
Yeah, right. Yeah. You don't want a lot of food on the ground. So stick with sunflower on the ground. And if you want to put something, sunflower in their feeder, if you want to put something on the ground, then maybe you can put one of those mixes on the ground and let the sparrows and the doves pick through it a little bit.
Oh,
like that.
That's good. That's good to know because I fell for the mix thing.
Everybody does. Yeah, it looks they market it better.
Yeah,
and they can get more money for it.
But you know, I have to tell you, this is interesting because when I first filled the feeders for the season, I did that. I had some different kinds and I put separate ones, and I had loads of birds. And this last time, I got a big bag of some mixed kind. I filled all the feeders with the mix. I have some birds, but not like I did when I first fed them. So I gotta go back.
Yeah,
to that.
go back to sunflower. I know it doesn't sound appealing or sexy to people, and the manufacturers come up with all these clever, you know, New England's Finest blend and the Cardinals Love Mix or some crazy ass name like that. But it's not really. You end up with more on the ground than you do, and you end up spending more money than you need. No matter what ingredients you put in there, it won't be better than sunflower.
Yeah. What about the suet? Does it matter what kind of suet you put in?
Suet's good. I probably in the wintertime, the best kind is just that kind of grocery store raw suet.
Mm-hmm.
Trouble with that, it spoils. So you have to use that when it's really cold.
Right.
The rest of the year, the suet you can buy that's the kind of year-round suet, and has some grain in there to hold it together.
Mm-hmm.
That works fine, too. You can use that any time of the year.
My suet doesn't last long enough to go bad.
I know. It depends where you live. My suet lasts forever, but I live in a kind of a crummy neighborhood that just has cedars and stuff, and I don't get many woodpeckers.
Yeah.
But the people that have woodpeckers, we sell a lot of suet. So it's a really popular way.
Exactly. All right. You know, I said you wouldn't want to eat that icky seed on the bottom of the bird feeder, and you actually had a question in here about, it was a woman who asked you if humans could eat, I think it was thistle. Do you know remember the question I'm talking about?
That's my favorite.
I love that question
ever.
Where she said something. She didn't eat it, but she had a
house
guest who she came downstairs and the house guest was eating the thistle.
It's on our answering machine. I got to work one day. I put the answering machine on. And is thistle harmful to people? I bought some at your store and I put it in a container when I got home. And I got up in the morning. The house guest was eating it for breakfast.
Oh my God,
we played that message about 300 times.
What did you tell her?
I told her, you'll never see that guest again. No, I mean, it's just grain. It's fine. I'm sure, you know, it comes from, it's actually Niger seed. Thistle's actually Niger seed, comes from overseas. And they eat it over there. You know, they make an oil out of it, I think. But, you know, we give it to birds. But it's fine.
That house guest is going, man, you wouldn't believe the stuff she serves for breakfast. We're talking with Mike O'Connor. His book is Why Do Bluebirds Hate Me? More answers to common and not so common questions about birds and birdings. 866-999-4626 is our toll-free number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is the point at capeandislands.org. Another question in the book has to do with the blue jay and eating paint. Kind of an obscure question, and your answer was offer them baked chicken eggshells?
Yeah, it's not as unusual as we thought it would be. Mm-hmm. The customer found that they had some part of their house was peeling, and the blue jays were landing and plucking the paint right off. And it sounds like worse than eating thistle seed. And it turns out that the paint has some calcium benefits for the birds. So what we suggest to people to do is if you eat eggs and you have some eggshells, bake them for a little bit to dry them out and to get some of the whatever. You know, you don't want them to be raw eggs out there. And then grind them up and sprinkle them out there, and the birds will pick them up. I know a lot of people that raise chickens, they give them calcium, and they also use the old eggs if you get back to the chickens. And especially the females, when it comes to egg-producing season for them, they draw a lot of calcium out of their own bodies, so you can replace it with that.
You know, there was another thing you had there. Somebody asked about why there wasn't the chickens in the bird books. And I never even thought about it, but they're not native.
They're not native species, no.
Yeah.
No,
so that's
not at all.
Yeah.
But there's, I guess they all come from a red jungle fowl or something from Asia. That's where all our domestic chickens come from. But no, they're not. Yeah, they're not a native bird.
Yeah.
Neither are some other common birds, especially pheasants.
I thought, pheasants.
We love pheasants now. They're not native.
You know, the interesting thing I thought that, you know, you should have dedicated this book to shy people. You sort of did in your intro, in the fact that you say there's, when you talk to, you know, there's always people that want to ask questions, but they're a little bit, you know, they don't want to speak up. They don't want to be the first. They don't want to ask a stupid question. As we know, there's no stupid questions, really. But and this, I think the same thing happens with Vern. Sometimes when we're at pub night and somebody goes, some guy will come up, hey, Vern, can I talk to you? And you go over in the corner, and it's not sports. He's like, okay, I have this little bird. And you find the same thing in the store. People bring you over to a corner and say, Mike, I got this question.
Yeah. And you think I was doing like I was Dr. Ruth or something like that.
No, it's
the bird questions.
Yeah. So this is sort of dedicated to all those shy people who don't like to ask the questions.
You know, it's amazing that I was giving a talk the other night, and you know, since we've been doing the column's somewhat popular, but you know, in my mind, I've got kind of an audience, you know, kind of retired people that feed birds, not unlike myself, even though I'm not retired, but a lot of people who are into that. And sometime I'll be like going to Stop and Shop, I'll be walking through the parking lot, and a guy will come up to me, and you know, he looks like he just cut down trees for a living, this big guy. And I'm thinking, he comes up, hey, and he calls me over, and I'm thinking, oh, I must have cut him off in traffic, and he's mad at me about something, you know, and I don't know whether to run or whatever. And he comes over, you that bird guy? I say, yeah. I love the goldfinches. I like what you wrote. Yeah, goldfinches. I don't expect it from this guy. You know, he looks like he wants to go to a bullfight or something.
Yeah. What's your favorite bird?
Of course, it's the chickadee.
And why?
Because it's the best bird ever. That's why. I mean, first of all, it's so stinking cute.
You got to admit that, yeah.
And did you hear anybody? I mean, there's not a bird people don't complain about. You know, the crows wake me up, the blue jays take all the seed, the sparrows are mean to the little birds, and blah, blah, blah. But nobody complains about a chickadee.
No, because there's nothing to complain about.
And plus, as a retailer, it's the best bird. Mm-hmm. They come to feeders, they come to bird baths.
They're the first ones.
They're the first ones, right. You put
the curious little ones.
Exactly. You put up a birdhouse, they'll go to that, and they never leave. Mm-hmm. Ever leave.
You have to
the other birds take off in the wintertime, they always stay here.
Your chickadee will never leave you.
Exactly. Yeah. And they always look the same.
Yeah.
You know, there's not these stupid goldfinches.
You have to figure out what
color we're going to be, gold, brown, you know. Now, chickadees always look awesome. And there's no male, female. They look
the same.
Great. They're the best.
All right. Sandra's giving us a call from Harwich. Hi, Sandra.
Hi there, Mindy. Love your show, always.
Thanks.
I have a question about birds, and I'm so glad you're on today. Several weeks ago, I found about 45 little, beautiful little gray feathers, and it's a soft gray, sort of a light gray. Some of them have white tips, and they were on the ground, so they varied from 1.5 inch to the longest were 6 inches. Wow. This bird did not make it, I think, with that many feathers gone. But I'm wondering, there were also two other feathers. One is it's very beautiful. It's mottled, sort of a tawny and brown, and that's about 8 or 9 inches long, and then there's a very black one, and that's about the same length. So I'm wondering if you could guess, or if your guess can guess, what happened out there? Who got this poor little bird?
Do you have any clue, Mike?
Well, you want to say mourning dove right away because they seem to get it all the time. And
really?
Yeah.
Okay.
We do have, and there is a book out called Just Four Feathers. Mm-hmm. You know, it's an identification guide just for feathers. And I didn't ever think they would make such a book because feathers are pretty complicated. And birds have a great variety of feathers depending on their age and sex and everything. But there is a book out for that. So if you got a clump of those feathers, find that book or swing by our store. We can we'll take the book out for you. You can check it out. But just off the top of my head.
And we'll ask Vern when Vern's on if he has any clue. But the other thing, it's too bad we don't have little Keith Gagnon here, that little six-year-old who's feather display at Mass Audubon. He is so cute. I don't know how he knows. I swear he's a little savant of a person with these feather identifications. His dad brought him in a feather and said, "Here, I got you. What do you say? I got you an osprey feather." And he said, "Thanks for the turkey feather, Dad." So cute.
Where was
so
this? Cute.
He has a feather display at the wildlife sanctuary in Wellfleet Bay Wildlife Sanctuary. Yeah, you'll have to check it out. If you can get when he's there, oh boy, you're in for a treat.
I'll call him and find out.
Great, Sandra. Thanks for the phone call.
Thank you very much.
All right. So some of the other questions you have in there, birds eat insects, especially when they're feeding their young, and bees are considered a special treat for some bird species. Surprised to learn this unique way summer tanagers avoid getting stung by bees?
Summer tanagers, they most birds really don't like bees. You know, they have a healthy respect. Yeah. Anybody that puts out a hummingbird feeder knows when the bees are around, the birds tend to avoid it. But summer tanagers go out of their way to look for bees. And they grab them, and then they take them to a perch and beat the snot out of them back and forth on the branch. And then they work the business end of the bee back and forth to get the stinger off, boink, and then down the hatch.
Oh, my goodness.
That's right. Yeah. And, you know, there seems to be no shortage of bees sometimes.
That's for sure. We got an email question from Janet. She says, "We've put up 5 suet feeders. Squirrels have taken them all down and run away from them. What can we do about this?" Oh, this is a problem we have. Those darn squirrels.
Who asked that?
Janet, but you get this a lot, I'm sure, in the store.
You get this a lot. Okay, here's the deal, Janet. Don't blame the squirrels this time. This sounds very raccoonish to me.
Ooh.
Raccoons love to take stuff, especially at night. So if you put your feeders up and you find them on the ground in the morning or missing in the morning, that's 100% raccoons. Squirrels don't work at night. They take the night off.
Mm-hmm.
They're watching TV, reading a book, whatever they do. But the raccoons work the night shift, and they take stuff and take it with them.
Mm-hmm. A lot the squirrels of do it too, though.
Well, not so. I mean, you have to have it really poorly hung up if they're going to take something, and they're not that strong.
Mm-hmm.
So any kind of tethering will keep a squirrel from taking it, but the raccoons are tremendously strong and tremendously agile. They also hate each other.
Mm-hmm.
So when one raccoon gets food, the other ones want it, so they want to take it and run away with it. And a lot of times they take it up to the top of a tree to keep the other ones away.
Mm-hmm.
So if you've got a problem with suet disappearing at night, my advice is to take it in at night. Put it in a convenient place where you can just pluck it and take it in at night. There are raccoon baffles, which get a little bit pricey with a pole system and stuff like that. That'll stop that. I have a lot of my feeders on poles with raccoon baffles. But I have some I can't use the baffles on, so I just take them in at night, and that solves that problem.
Mm-hmm.
I think you'll find, Janet, that if you take your feeders in at night and put them out during the day, this theft will stop.
Yeah. You know, I have a feeder that had an old pole and it broke, and I had it hanging from the tree. So last year I battled those squirrels all the time because they could jump on it. So I bought a new pole and I put it up, and didn't the first day I see a squirrel back up on that little sucker climbed right up that pole.
Right up the pole.
I took that can of Crisco, went out there and slicked that pole, and that solved that problem. He can't get up there anymore. I know. It's an all constant battle.
It is
with
a
those squirrels.
Battle.
I mean, they have to eat too, I know. But,
don't you? I wish my kids were as smart as squirrels. Well, I'm not kidding. They can solve
anything.
Kind of problem.
I know that. And you don't always get bird questions. You get some unusual questions sometimes. Here's one. "Dear bird folks, I just returned from Cape Cod. I stopped at your shop with a question, but neither of the two young saleswomen could answer it.
Uh-oh.
I'd like to know where in Orleans Margaret Stanger, the author of The Quail, Robert, lived. Many thanks, John."
How about that?
Yeah, right? So it's like that. Now you're
With a travel guide.
You're
now
a travel guide, exactly.
Yeah. Martha Stanger did live in Orleans, and in a house that's actually marked with a little historical marker. And the last I knew, Robert the Quail was actually buried on her property.
Yeah.
At least that's the local rumor anyway. Yeah. But the house is right there on that people can see, but Yeah. You know, it's funny. We sold that book for years, and it's incredibly. Did you ever read it?
No, I haven't.
No, I know. Yeah. And neither did I, and we sold them. And then one day we had a storm, and the power went out. And so everybody's just sitting in the house, you know, in the dark, you know, like, look, waiting for the power to come on. So I got a headlamp, and I picked the book up, and I read the whole thing. And it's really, really well done. It's a really charming book. And it's an amazing how much of a big deal that bird was at the time. And it got national attention. I think it was on, like, the Tonight Show or some crazy thing like that.
So do you get a lot of unusual questions, right, besides the bird questions? I mean, that's, like, one of them. So you just never know what people are going to want to know from you.
No. I don't know.
And how do you answer these questions that you're like, okay, it's got nothing to do with birds?
Well, you know.
Doesn't make the column, right?
Doesn't make the column. No.
Or the book.
No, we do the best we can. I mean, right. We're not we don't sell things for bats. I don't know anything about bats.
Right.
But that's a tie-in because some reason they think because bats fly, we do it. So now, what are we going to do with the bats? And I said, I don't know anything about bats. But they don't stop.
Yeah.
They said, what about this? Okay. I still don't know anything about bats.
We're talking with Mike O'Connor. His book is Why Do Bluebirds Hate Me? More Answers to Common and Not So Common Questions About Birds and Birding. 866-999-4626 is our toll-free number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. Hummingbirds are fast, but they do have predators. And you mention in your book some unexpected hummingbird predators. Spiders? Praying mantis? Spiders, really? Spiders?
Yeah, they get caught in the webs, and they just spin them right up. And praying mantis, if you go online, there's crazy amounts of pictures of praying mantis that will just go to a hummingbird feeder and just wait. And they pluck the bird off, and then they just chew them
like a Oh, my gosh, I never heard of
that. Yeah, and you think it's a freak, but if you look online, there's a lot of pictures.
And how do the spiders? Spiders seem kind of small.
Well, I think they end up in the net.
Oh,
and then they just kind of work them up.
Yeah, gotcha.
then they go to town. Okay. Somebody had this great picture. Somebody from, I don't know, I want to say New Jersey. I could be wrong. But a snake.
Oh, I saw that picture.
Yeah, that creepy?
Yeah, it was a black snake,
A black snake. Yeah. It came right up, went up there. They sent me a whole series of pictures. A snake went up the railing of their porch and then over the doorknob of the screen and then up into the hummingbird feeder and curled around the hummingbird feeder. And the hummingbird, they're afraid of bees, but it didn't back down on the snake. No. It just kept working its way around.
They're fast.
Right. Yeah. And the people said they watched it for a long time. This wasn't a one-time thing. It happened a couple of times. And the snake had zero interest in the hummingbird. It was getting the insects that were coming.
Isn't that funny?
To the hummingbird.
You must have put that up on your website.
Facebook site,
I think we connected it on our Facebook page because it was on our Facebook page with the
People right away, oh, yeah, that was Photoshop, blah, 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 blah. And all the people sent me a video.
That's
really
wild.
Yeah.
All right, Liz has given us a call from Harwich. Hi, Liz.
Hi, how are you today?
Good.
I wanted to let you know I was recently at the Wellfleet Bay Wildlife Sanctuary, and Keith now has a bird nest.
I heard he was doing that.
Yeah, it's really fascinating. It's quite well done and certainly worth going to see. He is a remarkable young man.
Isn't he? He's so adorable. He's so cute. Oh, I can't say. You know, we did a interview with him it's up on the Bird News page from the first show, I think, where we talked about his collection. And he's just so darn cute.
He is cute, and he is so smart. Almost humiliating. It sounds. I was at that age. That was not my focus. Just trying to get to school on time, really.
Right.
But I do have a question. I have friends coming in this weekend, and I know with all the migration that's going on, they read your column, Mike, in, I think, the end of March, the 1st of April, and they're fascinated with the opportunity to see the gull shark. The gull
it's like
shark.
It's gull sharks. Don't laugh. Yes. Go ahead,
so
Liz.
My question is, do you think it's already migrated, or is there do you think there's a chance that we might be able to catch it?
I think the gull sharks have moved on. They only appear on April 1st.
Have you ever heard of them before, Liz?
Oh, my gosh. This is not going to be good when I tell them.
Oh,
they're
take
really
them down. Take them down to Chatham to see the gull shark. They might be a few still around.
Okay, well, thank you so much.
All right, Liz, thanks for the call. All right, ornithologist Vernon Locks is going to, I know he's dying on the other end here. He's been sitting here listening to us. Morning, Vern.
Good morning.
Vern's joining us from the Linda Loring Nature Foundation. And Vern, you've got the birding festival starting. Is it today or tomorrow it starts?
It starts this afternoon. Can you hear me all right?
We can hear you, yeah.
Okay, good. There's something wrong with my headphones. Just give me a moment.
Okay. All right.
Okay, cool.
All right, so Vern, in the meantime, when you heard this gull sharks, were you going, what the heck are they talking about?
Well, I realized it had something to do with Mike. So I immediately suspected a prank. Yeah. I wrote an April Fool's column in the Vineyard Gazette about 20 years ago, and I had penguins porpoising in Vineyard Haven Harbor and great white sharks and some people actually believed it.
Yeah, of course.
I got phone calls it was amazing.
Yeah, don't believe anything you read on April Fool's.
Oh
right?
My gosh! No.
Oh, it's a great thing to pull the birder's legs. You know?
Hey, Vern, I don't know if you heard when Sandra called in from Harwich and she found those gray feathers. Did you hear that phone call?
I did.
You did. What did you think it was morning?
Mike hit the nail on the head. It was sounded like a classic morning dove getting taken by a Cooper's hawk.
Ah, okay.
They love to eat morning doves. They're just the right size for them. Of course, they also like pigeons. Every time I'm on one of the ferries, the rock pigeons, both on Nantucket and Hyannis or Woods Hole, daily there's Cooper's hawks that come in, usually in the morning and again just before dark, and they keep thinning the ranks of the pigeons. Which is not good. The pigeons don't enjoy this,
no,
of course not.
Yeah. Well, now we've got Vern and Mike. So if you have questions, 866-999-4626. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. So Vern, tell us about the festival, because we talked about this on the Bird Show, but for folks who weren't listening, we have that, what is that, Patagonia picnic table? What was that called again?
The Patagonia picnic table effect.
Okay, and we've got something.
The Patagonia picnic table was a little rest area down in southern Arizona, not far from the Mexican border. And some bird watchers were having lunch there, and they look over, and there's a little sparrow hopping around in the thicket to the side. And it turns out it's a Mexican bird called a five-striped sparrow. And it's the first time one had ever been seen in north of the Mexican border in the U.S. So bird watchers from around the country, the people that are serious about it and keep a list and stuff, all went down to southern Arizona. And then they compiled an impossible string of rare birds. They kept finding more and more birds. And so basically, when you flood an area with good birders, they keep finding more and more birds. So this will be our third annual, the Linda Loring Nature Foundation Nantucket Birding Festival, that starts tonight. And then we have field trips. And the first 2 years, we have 12 really good leaders. A lot of the people that go on the trip, we have a lot of beginners, which is perfectly great, but we also have a lot of experienced people. And it just seems that we just keep turning up. It has a snowball effect. Mm-hmm. You know, you find one rare bird and then everybody will go to see it, and boom, all of a sudden we find five new birds that were unknown. Last year, when my leaders got here on Thursday afternoon and started scouting before our introductory dinner, they discovered a bird that was just completely unbelievable. It had never been seen. It had only been seen twice before in the continental United States. And one of those was in Oregon and one was in Washington State like 30 years ago. A little shorebird called a gray-tailed tattler. Gray-tailed tattlers nest in streams in Siberia and winter in Southeast Asia and to Australia. And they're not even common. They're rare there. So to find one... It's a really nondescript bird, too. I mean, really, there's only a handful of people, probably in eastern North America, that would have recognized it. And fortunately, they were one of my leaders on the Nantucket Birding Festival. So
you're expecting to see some unusual things this weekend.
We set the bar really high. I'm sort of hyperventilating right now. I'm foaming at the, I can't wait to get out there and start birding. And the wind, it looks like the weather's really cooperating, too, because all we've had for weeks, it seems like, is these northeast winds. And if you think about where land birds or birds are going to come from, if it comes blowing in off the ocean, unless it's blowing 60 miles an hour for weeks on end, like it did with Superstorm Sandy, which blew the northern lapwings out here, There's really very, we don't get birds from Europe. The birds we get are things from Asia and the West Coast that blow across on westerly winds, and it pushes them out to the coastline, and then that acts as a real physical barrier, and then the birds start moving south. So mm-hmm. Nantucket's like a, I envision it as a life ring 30 miles out mm-hmm. to sea for these birds yeah. that have been pushed out over the ocean. So I actually expect the unexpected out here.
Is it too late for people to participate, Vern?
I'm sorry, Mike?
Is it too late for people to participate in the festival?
No, as a matter of fact, it isn't. If they were either just to call here at the Linda Loring Nature Foundation at 508-325-0873, we could help them out. Or they could still go on our website and sign up. We have we have some spaces left, and it's a really, really great event, and we keep the cost way down. It's a whole package. I mean, it's dinner Thursday night, field trips Friday morning, Friday afternoon, lunch is included. It's dinner Friday night. It's field trips Saturday morning, lunch Saturday, field trip Saturday afternoon. Then we have a big a talk. Richard Prum, the world's expert on feathers. Richard is the curator. He's the head of the Peabody Museum at Yale University. He's won a MacArthur Genius Grant Award for his work on feathers and feather evolution.
When's his talk?
He happens to be just a great speaker, and he's speaking at the Athenaeum in downtown Nantucket at 7 o'clock on Saturday night, and then Sunday morning we have what we call a rarity roundup. So we'll take the buses. We'll decide what we want to see, what we found, and the buses will go to different places birding. And it's all over by noon, and people can catch a 125 ferry back to the Cape.
Yeah, and we're going to have a link up on our webpage, too, to Linda Loring Nature Foundation. So at capeandislands.org, we have a link there as well. So
great.
Folks want more information on that. And, Vern, you pick this time of year intentionally because, like you say, this is the birders' like Super Bowl kind of, you know, this is when all the action happens, this migration time, right?
So far, we've guessed really right, and I would say that this is the best weekend of the year for birds on Nantucket. And so far, I've been right. Of course, a lot of that, again, is probably the coverage we're going to get. Mm-hmm. But it also, I mean, the global warming, in my mind, has been proven, and some of the data that's been gathered on a whole bunch of things has clearly shows that birds are coming north earlier in the spring and departing later in the fall. So it used to be really that September and even Columbus Day used to be considered the best time, but I think it's actually these dates, this weekend is going to be it. Mm-hmm. There's still lots of falcons on the move. The winds right now are southwest, which is good. We might get some blowback things like scissor-tailed flycatchers, Western Kings. We might get some southern warblers that come in.
But it's not just Nantucket, right? I mean, if you're somebody who can't get out to the birding festival, this is a good weekend, like you say, on the vineyard to be over at the cliffs looking for some of those birds migrating.
I'm a little biased because I'm going to be here. Yeah. But no, this is a weekend to get outside and bird wherever you can. I'm in Chatham, the Outer Cape, Sandwich Woods Hole. There'll be birds moving down the Elizabeth Islands. The western tip of the vineyard, the cliffs at Gay Head, should be rather spectacular. It's good to get up there as early as possible mm-hmm. because it seems a lot of these birds are nocturnal migrants. And as the sun is coming up in the morning, they reorient once the sun crosses the horizon. And there'll be nothing. I've been up there in the dark and really had no birds at all. And then the sun comes up and it's like somebody throws this invisible mm-hmm. switch. And birds just start streaming from the south shore, the north shore. They just come up, they get up, and they realize they don't want to be out here. They want to go back to the west, to the mainland. And then they hit a barrier like the Gay Head Cliffs, and they see the water, the open ocean, and then they climb. They go up in big circles. It's amazing. Sometimes you'll have birds streaming along. There'll be a low-level group. There'll be a mid-level group. And then you'll even have a group so high up in your binoculars that you lose them. And once they climb, and then they just sort of take a slow glide, like descending a staircase back towards the mainland, over to Westport, Mass, and Buzzards Bay. And some actually even head, I'm sure they can see Block Island, and you can see some of the birds sort of just head in that southwesterly direction. But clearly at the altitude they're at, they can see a long way.
One thing you're not probably going to see on Nantucket this weekend that we have plenty of here in the Cape, tufted titmouse, right? They don't like the water. They won't fly over that water.
There has never been a tufted titmouse on Nantucket, but, you know, I they're a very interesting bird. And when they colonized Cape Cod, there were no tufted titmice on Cape Cod until 1976. I was working at the Hyannis Airport, I remember, and I happened to be coming back from Boston one day, and I'm driving over the Bourne Bridge, and I see, I'm looking up, and there's tufted titmice, flocks of them, moving from girder to girder across the bridge. They wouldn't even fly across the canal.
Yeah, see?
That's too much water.
I got plenty of them in my yard.
And then they invaded, and now, of course, they've colonized all of the Cape, and they're even in the Elizabeth. And then, about 15 years ago, they made the jump to Martha's Vineyard, which, of course, that's the closest point from Nobscot Point to West Chop is about 4 miles.
Wow.
And there is some thought. Somebody, I know two people that claim to have seen tufted titmice on the ferries.
Oh, how funny. All right, we got full lines here, so let's go to some phones. Ed's calling from Wellfleet. Hi, Ed.
Hey, good morning. I've enjoyed your program for a number of years, and I saw a bird I'd like some help identifying. Sunday afternoon about 1 o'clock, I was out towards Race Point Lighthouse, and about 100 yards off into the brush, there was a very large, dark brown with a little bit of cinnamon in the wings bird. It was gliding low, not quite as large as the buzzards we have around here, and it stayed fairly close to the ground. Not sure what it might have been.
I love the description, cinnamon, not brown, cinnamon. That's great.
That's a really good description, and it's I think that's a pretty easy one.
What is it?
He's describing a northern harrier, probably a young female. I loved how he compared its flight to a vulture or something, because what they do is they quarter very slowly and low over the beach grass, the marsh grass, with their wings held a little above a horizontal in what's called a dihedron. And they're rodent specialists. If you get really close to them, you can see their face has a concentric disc like an owl, and their facial feathers actually concentrate sound. They hunt mostly by sight, but they hear the mice squeaking, and they also use sound a lot. So that's a really great description, I think, of a northern harrier. I hope Mike agrees with me.
Well, you know, I think we like the rodent specialist description. It's a rodent specialist. Ed, thanks for the phone call. Prince is calling from Woods Hole. Hi, Prince.
Hello. So about a week ago, I had a very strange almost sparrow. It looked like a sparrow. It had the same kind of streaking on the sides, but it had an olive green head and nape to the neck, and a brown, kind of chestnut brown back, and it had six longitudinal stripes on the head, and then six on the back. And I've been looking in Sibley's and can't find anything that looks like it.
Okay, Vern.
The beauty of digital photography. That's a tough. How big a bird was this?
It was the size of a sparrow. I mean,
a house sparrow, a song sparrow.
That kind of 6-inch long, maybe.
And it had a sparrow. Did it have a short, thick bill like a sparrow? Or it was
really
a seed-eating bird, you think?
At the bill that much. The legs were dark, and it was kind of bouncing around like it was going after insects or spiders in the grass.
Ah.
It was all solo. It's not like the flocks of sparrows that I get here that are all mixed.
Right.
Guess we need a picture.
Well, I'm sort of at a loss on this one. I was thinking it was some kind of tanager initially, but I would encourage you to take a digital photo, even if you have an iPhone, a phone, or something. Any kind of a photo is really is really useful. I don't know, Mike. You want to hazard a guess on that?
No, I got nothing. Okay. It's interesting. It was picking off insects, though. Do you think it could have been some kind of fall warbler? Perhaps.
No stripes.
Yeah, well, it could have. Yeah, I don't know. It could have been. Certainly, it was insectivorous. It could have. Yeah, it could have been a warbler. It could have been.
I mean, the closest that I've seen is like maybe a blackpoll warbler with really.
There was a lot of blackpolls pushing through. Last
week. There are a lot of blackpolls. I've seen them in gardens and on lawns and stuff catching insects, and they're sort of a bright greeny on the back with a lot of streaking, a couple of prominent wing bars, and they actually have sort of bright yellow feet. But,
yeah, so she's yeah, a dark feet, yeah.
The yellow feet is the thing that throws me off, because I don't think they were yellow, or I would have noticed it.
Prince, if you see it again, grab a photo, and then we can tell you for sure.
I mean, I've seen it once.
Yeah. That's right. And you never have a camera when you're when you've got that going, right? I know. It's tough. Sometimes those birds, they don't like their photo taken. Prince, thanks for the phone call. That happened to me a couple of weeks ago, Vern. Remember, I was trying to figure out what that cute little bird was and kept trying to get these photos. They were very blurry, but then I figured it out. And same thing, went to the bird book, and it didn't look like the picture of the white-breasted nuthatch, but that's exactly what it was, because I looked at some pictures online which were better photos. And so sometimes it's hard, even looking at the photos, you've got the right bird.
It's really hard to figure out what a bird is from the book. And that's why it's really great to go out with it. It's nice to, you can learn so much going out with someone that already knows the stuff. It really speeds up your learning curve quite a bit.
That's for sure.
Because everybody starts out as a beginner, so... Mm-hmm. You know, it's like I really enjoy taking people out that don't, if they know nothing, that's fine.
Yeah.
All they just, you just want them to have a good attitude and be interested, because you can, and then you're happy to share whatever you can with them.
Yep. All right. Larry's calling from Truro. Hi, Larry.
Hi.
Yep. Go ahead, Larry.
Hello.
Yep.
Morning.
Go ahead.
Yeah. Two quick questions. One, I had a Carolina wren outside my bedroom window last summer. It woke me up. Beautiful. If I leave the nest there, will it return? And two, a neighbor has told me that these mouse bait traps are very bad to use because they wander outside and they damage raptors.
Yep. But I know what you're doing. Using the poison stuff you're talking about for the mice, and then the raptors eat the mice. Yeah, that's a problem. Right, Vern?
Yes, it is. Yeah, it's bad news.
Yeah,
it's a kidney. So I don't recommend poisoning anything, rats or mice, because, of course, they go out and they're in trouble and they get eaten by raptors, and that certainly those poisons are not just specific for rodents. As far as the Carolina wren nest goes, you can remove it. The wren will not use that nest again. They never do, and it probably has some parasites, some feather mites and things. So, and the wren probably will come back if you remove the nest. I'll bet it may rebuild the nest right next to it or right in the same spot next spring. But they do not use the same nest again, so don't worry about getting rid of the nest.
That's a nice little bird, Carolina wren. Nice little song, right?
Oh, they're singing now. Yeah. They're the only bird you can really yapping right now.
Yeah, Larry, thanks for the phone call. And you know, that's interesting because I wondered the same thing, and I think I've asked you this, Vern, about I have the house finch that likes to nest in a wreath I had outside my front door, and I did not remove the nest, and it came back the next year, but it put a nest on top of the wreath instead of inside the wreath. Then we painted the house, so we took down the wreath. It went into one of the plants this year, one of my hanging plants, same on that same porch. So, every year I have a little nest somewhere on that porch. Yeah, so they do come back. Yeah.
You know, back to that guy with the mice again. I think if you get the traps, even those little cage traps that have a hard traps, then you're not just putting out poison. Mm-hmm. You've got if you indeed trying to get rid of mice, you catch the mice and then you can either release it or destroy it if that's what you're inclined to do. But just not putting out poison that you don't know what's going to ingest it and then what it's going to pass it on to other things. So if you put out a cage trap, you at least know you've got your target animal because maybe you'll get a chipmunk and you don't want a chipmunk.
You want to
release it.
Somebody had said, and I don't know if you've heard this, but I don't know, maybe Vern, you told me this, and rats, to get rid of them, and when they have the holes there in the ground, you stuff it with steel wool. And does that work?
Yeah, they don't like chewing steel wool.
Right, yeah.
I had a couple of houses I've lived in that were old with there was big gaps along the sill in the basement, and I tried everything, and the rats would chew through it, and then someone told me about the steel wool, and I put it in it. Boy, it works.
It does work. Okay. I mean, the same thing. I mean, believe it or not, we have a lot of birdseed where I work, and the mice are always there in and out. And the same thing.
Yeah.
They'd chew the holes through the ceiling, through everything, and we put it in the steel wool and shut
and
them right
works.
Down.
And that works. Okay, that's a good one. All right. Tom is calling from South Dartmouth. Hi, Tom.
Hi. Hi, guys. Hello.
Good morning.
We visited you, Vern. My wife and I rode out to Linda Loring this summer, and we had a delightful 45-minute chat with you on the veranda where you identified everything that flew by, crawled by. but I wanted to report earlier in the show mentioned that the finch feeder. We, at our finch feeder, I buy a finch mix, and we get finches, woodpeckers, nuthatches, and chickadees all summer, and on, that's on one hook on our deck, and on the other hook we have our hummingbird feeder, and the hummingbirds have been really active this year. Mm-hmm. That there's just wanted to pass along, there are, we bought two expensive feeders. They're called Squirrel Buster. There's a Squirrel Buster Plus and a Squirrel Buster Finch feeder, and the squirrels have not gone on.
That worked, huh? Yeah, good, yeah, Tom. That's good information.
They are expensive. They're made in Canada, and I think they're lifetime guaranteed.
Yeah.
But they're amazing. The squirrels have not done it. And I haven't found anything else that works like that.
Yeah.
No, yeah, thanks for that. That's actually what we've found, too. You know, over the years, we've gone through dozens of different kind of squirrel-proof feeders that work for a short period of time.
Right.
And then somewhere along the line, the squirrels...
figure something out.
Figure it out, and then they post it on their Facebook page, and all the squirrels start feeding it. And now the Squirrel Buster has been, you know, we've had it for, I don't know, 7 or 8 years, and it's still been a good time. So you're right. It's been very successful.
Tom, thanks for that. Because
Tom, before you go, do you still have hummingbirds at your feeder?
No, they left around September 28th, and they arrived almost on schedule. I think it's at the, April 20th. The last day in April, almost you can almost set your watch.
Hmm.
But the last ones left at the just around September 28th.
Because if you get a hummingbird at your feeder now, it's probably not a ruby throat. Mm-hmm. So you need if you still have your feeders up, you may get a. I'm willing to bet if you got a bird that showed up, it wouldn't be a ruby throat, and we need to get somebody over to look at it.
Yeah, Tom. Thanks for the phone call.
I took the feeders down. So.
Yeah.
Okay.
All right. So, Vern, Jenny's saying she has some hummingbirds still at her feeders. Yeah. She's shaking her head. Yeah. She says.
Get some pictures.
Get some pictures because they might. Are they ruby throated, Jenny? Do you know? She doesn't know. All right. Get some pictures. We might have to walk down to Jenny's after the show, Mike, and find out what they are. you know, you had another interesting question in the book that I hadn't really thought about, and it was about parakeets. It says, dear bird folks, when I was a kid, I enjoyed visiting my spinster aunt in Cincinnati because she had a pet parakeet, what some people call a budgie. I've always assumed these parakeets were descendants of wild birds, but I never knew where they came from. My question is, where are parakeets from? Are they still found in the wild?
Yeah, the budgies, Australia.
And they're all called Pretty Boy.
Pretty Boy. And everybody called him pet bird. Every aunt had
Pretty Boy.
Pretty Boy. They were big. Don't you remember? They were big back in the 50s and the 60s. Every Woolworths sold them.
Right. And with the pet turtles and the...
I've been lucky enough to go birding in Australia several times for almost over a year. And budgies, budgerigar is what its name is. I've traveled all over. I've guessed how many I've seen in the wild.
Zero.
In Australia, two.
Oh, two? Really?
Two.
That's it?
They're really scarce over there. Yeah. They trapped them all out. It turns out budgies are really hard to see in the wild. There's many more in captivity.
Yeah.
Pretty weird.
I mean, but nowadays where people kind of are more aware of where these wild birds come from, do we think they might increase their population in Australia?
You know, I don't know much. Yeah. I just thought I would see them everywhere. And I was looking and one... I was driving somewhere, and these two budgies come by going about 60 miles. I go, oh, my God, you know. Yeah. So my first wild budgies, and that was all I've ever seen. And I've seen 95% of the birds in Australia. And in my experience, budgies are really rare in the wild.
Wow. But so are we still capturing them in the wild? Or most of the parakeets that are sold here, they're bred in captivity, right?
They breed them all kinds of crazy colors.
I'm not a cage bird guy at all.
Yeah, I don't think you are either, Mike, right? You're not a cage bird guy either. No. So the columns continues, right? You're still writing the column?
Still writing the column, yep.
Yeah. And so will there be a book three at some point?
I don't know.
You run out of bird questions?
I don't know. We'll see. Yeah. I don't know. I have no predictions of that one.
Vern, I don't know if you heard us early on. We were talking about the book sort of dedicated to shy folks who don't like to, you know, raise their hand and feel like they're asking a silly question. But as we know, there's no silly questions, right? They're all good. But there are a lot of people who kind of take you to the side and say, Vern, I got this bird question.
I mean, it was funny hearing Mike talk because I can't go anywhere and people are like, and the people you just wouldn't expect them this. It's amazing that birds sort of cut across all generational barriers and, you know, economic barriers. There's, you know, it's amazing. It just sort of brings people together. I love it when people ask me questions.
It's as people get older, they remember from when they were kids, and maybe their grandparents were doing it, but they get away from it perhaps for a little bit, but then they get back to it, you know, when they get more time. But I think it's something that, you know, maybe it's like baseball with your dad or something. Mm-hmm. It's bird watching maybe with your aunt or your grandmother, and it's kind of like a cycle thing that they get back into it a little bit more.
Yeah. And also, too, like you've got, I'm sure you hear a lot, Mike, from the backyard birders, those who watch the birds in their yard. And then, of course, there are all kinds of levels, like Vern, you know, people who have the lists and go around the world trying to find certain birds or the country. So you can get involved on any level that you want.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Oh, yeah. There's people that bird way beyond my ability. They're out there. They're hardcore. They're out there on the pelagic trips looking at the seabirds and stuff. But there's the people that are very content with the cardinals and the chickadees.
Yeah, yeah. And, of course, you want to get a good pair of binoculars, right, Vern, if you're going to take up some birding?
Well, it makes such a huge difference to have good. I mean, it's one thing looking with your eyes, and when you get binoculars, it just opens a whole nother world.
But you know, I want to let me just jump in for a second. When you talked about the camera, the last few years, people with digital cameras, even crappy digital cameras, have really made a difference in terms of identification. Mm-hmm. What used to be like, but with the call I had earlier, Prince was giving us a bird, and we're all trying to grasp what it is. When people come in with even the most rudimentary camera images, it makes such a difference. Mm-hmm. Not only getting help with it, but my son's got a camera, and we go birding. And the days when we used to just struggle over the sparrows, now we snap some pictures and we can go home and pop them on the screen. And it's so much easier. So besides binoculars, maybe a camera is a really good thing. Yeah. It's really helpful. It really is.
So if you're not birding with Vern, because you know, Vern tells me what it is. Yeah.
And the beauty of digital cameras, I mean, compared to film, once you buy the camera and you have the memory chips, it's, you know, you can shoot away to your heart's content. You can just keep going. It doesn't cost you anything.
Yep. All right. So the Birding Festival begins this afternoon, and we've got a link up on our website, capeandislands.org, for the Nantucket Birding Festival, third annual. Ornithologist Vernon Locks. Vern, thanks for being with us this morning.
Thank you very much.
And Mike,
have a nice weekend.
You too. Mike O'Connor, Why Do Bluebirds Hate Me? More answers to common and not so common questions about birds and birding. Thanks, Mike, for driving all the way down from Orleans.
Yeah, how about that?
Appreciate that.
Big city.
Yep. I'm Mindy Todd. Thanks for listening.
Amy Vins produces The Point, with assistance from Jenny Junker. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter. The Point is a production of the Cape and Islands NPR stations, a service of WGBH.